This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. More than 5 million Americans age 65 and older have some form of dementia. That's according to the CDC. And the number is expected to triple by 2060. A cure is nowhere in sight yet. And in the meantime, the need for dementia care is only getting greater. So is it time to shift the focus from cure to care? Should vastly more money be invested in how to increase the health, well-being, and quality of life for the 14 million Americans who are expected to get this disease in the next 35 years? And can we do it on a large scale? Put another way, can we create a system where people don't just live with dementia, but live well? Well, those are the questions that inspired care workers in the Netherlands to create the Hogeveen Dementia Village right outside of Amsterdam. It opened in 2009, and the village is a residential nursing community specifically for people with severe dementia. Residents get the health care and supervision they need while also living freely in an entire community designed physically and socially for them. It's a revolutionary idea that has since caught on. There are similar models today in France, Norway, the UK, Australia, and Canada. But can this whole dementia village model work here in the United States? And if so, how? Well, Iris Van Sloten is an advisor at Be Advice, an advisory board of the Vivian Care Group, a care provider in the Netherlands with multiple locations for people living with severe dementia, including in that dementia village. She's also advised other nations on this model of care and assisted in opening similar facilities outside of the Netherlands. And she joins us today. Iris, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Meghna. Thank you for having me.
So, first of all, I wonder if you could take us back to before the Hogeveen, and I hope I said it correctly that time. Is that right?
Yes, it's with the Dutch, but that's very hard to pronounce.
Okay, so the Hogeveen Dementia Village was opened before 2009. Like, what was the kind of care that people with dementia were receiving in the Netherlands, and what gave rise to the idea of trying something completely different?
Actually, for ourselves, we on the same spot the community, the Hoogwijk, now is located on, we had a very traditional nursing home building on that same site. So it was three stories high, long wards, people in uniforms, a big dining area. I don't know if you are if you have any experience with a nursing home, but it was more like a hospital-like environment, really the traditional, more institutional way of nursing home care. But already 30 years ago, one of my now still colleagues at Be Advice, Jeanette Spearing, she was one of the management team members, and they really saw that it was time for a change, and they asked themselves the question, would this place be a place where I want to live if I might be diagnosed with dementia, or do I want my father or mother or partner living here? And the honest answer was no to all of them. So that really started the change, and that was the start of our vision, really a normal life for people living with dementia.
Yeah. So when they ask themselves, is this the kind of place that I would want to live? And the answer was no. Then, of course, the natural follow-on question that popped in my mind was, well, what kind of place would you want to live in if you were diagnosed with dementia? What were the answers or the thinking around that question before the Dementia Village opened?
Well, so it took on from there, the process, but what it was about, that it was that it should be about the individual. It should be about the person living in that place and needing to deal with dementia. And you want to continue your life, even though you are dealing with dementia. So you want to continue life like you did before and not be hospitalized. I always ask our visitors and the people we work with, would you want to live in a hospital for the rest of your life? And then always the answer, of course, is no. So then why did we do that to the people that were living with us? And why are we doing this still today? So it's about that you continue can continue with your life, that you stay a human being. And what makes you a human being, for instance, is that you can make your own choices every day. Like what I already explained, but having what do I have on my sandwich, or in what place do I want to be right now? Very, very simple choices we make every day, but are taken away from people that live in a nursing home.
Yeah. You know, it seems to me that in part because dementia is such a heartbreaking disease for the people, not only the person suffering from it, but from the people surrounding that person, that there seems to be this almost unconscious trajectory that care, at least in this country, takes, that as the dementia gets more and more severe, we think that the person who's suffering from it becomes less and less themselves, so we also then close the world in around them, right? But this, it sounds like the Dementia Village is exactly the opposite of that. So if I were to walk around in Hoogeveek, I'm going to keep trying to say it correctly, what would I see today?
You will enter through a door, and then you will enter the Hoogwijk, and that is a safe neighborhood where the outside of the homes are the barrier to the more broader surroundings. We had that door because there were laws in place back when we designed the Hoogwijk, that we had to keep people inside. You will find 27 homes in a normal looking community, a normal neighborhood. The homes look like normal Dutch homes, with a normal living room, a kitchen, private bedrooms. And when residents also step out of the front door, they're not on a ward bed, they are really outside. And there are many streets and many gardens they can explore. We have a restaurant, a pub, a theater, many club rooms, a supermarket. So everything you will find in any neighborhood, in any community. Very normal, and especially on a sunny day and in spring and in summer, of course, then you see a lot of people walking around, having conversations, meeting each other, grabbing a chair, enjoying a drink in the restaurant. It's just life.
And if I understand correctly, there's even transportation. Is there a bus?
No, you mean the bus stop?
Yeah, there's a bus stop there?
No, that's a misunderstanding.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, but it's maybe good to explain. That's something that's written about us a couple of times, I think, by people that haven't visited the Hoogwijk before. But it's sometimes referred as a fake world or a pretend world, but that's actually what it's not. So we don't fool people. It's a real normal neighborhood. Nobody's playing a role, and we do not fool people. It's no Truman Show, so to say.
I see. Okay, so people can go to the grocery store, like you said. They can go to the restaurant, pub. There's gardens, and at the same time, these are still, Dutch men and women who are suffering, I said earlier, from severe dementia. So,
yes.
What happens? Who else is working there? And do they have a special kind of training in order to interact with and assist and care for the residents in the village?
Yes. So, as you said, every resident that lives there has severe dementia. So, you need to have an indication from the Dutch government saying you have severe dementia. Otherwise, you cannot live in the Hoogwijk or any other nursing home in the Netherlands. So we offer highly complex care, skilled nursing. So we have staff, of course. We have teams in the houses that support the household and really run the household. But we also have a quite extensive medical support team, including a specialist elderly care, so doctor, but also a psychiatrist, a physiotherapist, a social coach, practitioner nurses, and they all support the teams in the houses. So we have most care on site.
Mm. And so for, you know, give me an example of how it works on a day-to-day basis. Say someone is, they left their home and they wanted to go to the village supermarket, but got lost or forgot the way. How does that work to help that person get to where they wanted to go?
Yeah. So one thing we highly value in the Hoogwijk is having freedom and giving the freedom to these people and not restraining them. So autonomy, freedom makes you a human being. So we do not walk hand in hand with the resident 24/7. No, they are free to walk around on their own. A lot of people can find their way because also people with severe dementia, they still have learning abilities and the place is designed that it's recognizable for them. Everybody that's working there needs to support the residents. So also the staff in the restaurant, also the reception, also the technicians, also me when I'm there. So when we see a person that's maybe, when I look out my office and I see somebody in the rain without a coat on, it might slip to the attention of a staff member in the house. But then it's also my job to go over there and find a jacket for that person. People will go to the supermarket together with staff.
I see. So, Iris van Sloten, hang on. There's so many more questions to ask of you and to learn about how this dementia village works in the Netherlands and then how replicable this model is elsewhere around the world, but particularly with the idiosyncrasies, let's put it that way, of the U.S. healthcare system. So we'll get to all that when we come back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we're talking about an idea that first began in the Netherlands about how to radically change how we care for people with dementia. Back in 2009, in the Netherlands, they created a dementia village. It's a whole community where people, even with severe dementia, can live freely because of the way the community is designed to help them maintain the highest quality of life possible. And I'm joined today by Iris van Sloten. She's an advisor at Be Advice, an advisory board with the Vivian Care Group. Now, this is the care provider that first opened the Hoogwijk Dementia Village back in 2009. And Iris, a little earlier you had said that you wanted to emphasize that this is that the village is not like the Truman Show, as you said, because everything is in fact real. Like the waiters in the restaurants are real. They just also have training in how to assist patients with dementia. And also, if I understand correctly, the village is open to the public, right? People can come and visit.
Yes.
Neighbors can come.
Yeah.
Even rent out facilities there.
Yes, correctly. We want people to stay part of society. So we want to be an inclusive neighborhood. The restaurant is open to everybody from the broader surroundings. We also, for instance, rent out a theater or the pub to companies or families from outside. So you will get that natural mingling of society. So we do not want to exclude the residents that are living in the Hoogwijk from the rest of the world. No, we just want to be that inclusive neighborhood so they can continue to be a part of society.
Okay. So it's been 14 years now, and that seems to be quite a substantial amount of time in order to see if it's working, right? Because the hope was that patients would be living a higher quality of life, that living in this environment would be better, not just for their physical well-being, but for their social and emotional well-being. What have the studies on the Dementia Village shown?
Many elements of the Hoogwijk concept, is how we're talking about. Uh-huh. They are have been studied. The Hoogwijk has been a topic of study in a lot of universities all around the world, and almost all elements, I would say, are scientifically proven now. So when you look at being outside, breathing in fresh air, eating in a normal dining setting, in a normal household, group size number, all those things moving there have been a lot of research on all those topics. So altogether, we now say that the Hoogwijk is evidence-informed, and you're correct. It's already 14 years old, so I would say that it works now after all this time. It's still there, and it's still seen as really the best practice in the world.
To put a fine point on it, can you say that there's evidence that people living in with the Hoogwijk concept are doing better than those who are in, say, a traditional nursing home?
Our experience is that we see with the residents that live in the Hoogwijk that they experience a higher quality of life. So and that's because they have more autonomy, they experience more freedom. We use less medication. We see less stress. People stay in a better mental and physical condition.
Uh-huh.
So yes.
Okay. So you're speaking to a mostly U.S.-based audience at the moment,
yes.
Iris, and so you can imagine that people are screaming at their radios at this time saying, this sounds amazing, but in the United States, there's always this question of cost, cost, cost. So how expensive is it to care for people with dementia in the village?
In the end, it's all about money, unfortunately, but it's also very important. But, it's difficult to compare numbers when you are in different countries with different rules and regulations and laws in place.
Yeah.
But when you compare it in the Netherlands, we are a non-profit nursing home and receive a budget from the government. So residents do not pay us directly. We get paid by the government, and we receive exactly the same budget as all other nursing homes in the Netherlands. And there are also still quite a few more traditional nursing homes in the Netherlands, more institutional ones. And that says that it's not about the amount of money, but it's about how do you use that and be creative with that money and to really put that resident first instead of all the systems and the protocols and the procedures and all the other hurdles you can think of.
Mm, okay. And so just to be clear, the residents do pay something, right? I'm seeing that there's a minimum of 175 euros per month and then a maximum of roughly 2,500 euros per month.
Yes, yes. Okay. Residents in the Netherlands, they pay back a contribution to the government, and that's leveled on your income and assets. But again, it's difficult to compare numbers and when you have totally different systems in place.
Yeah, fair enough. But the question is, can the concept work if modified appropriately for a new system, right? And so I would note that, you know, if we can say here in the United States, well, there's no you know, universal care in the United States. While that is still true, many, many people in nursing homes in this country are there because Medicaid is paying for it. So in a few minutes, we're going to talk about, could Medicaid actually embrace a model like the Dementia Village? So, Iris, hang on here for a minute, because I do want to refocus on what the reality is right now for many, many Americans when their family members get diagnosed with Alzheimer's or dementia. So Beth Onesworth, she was living a very rich life full of friends and music. As a member of her choir, she was independent in her own apartment in Philadelphia. And that started changing when Beth was about 69 years old. She began forgetting simple things like what day and time she had scheduled meetings, directions to common places, and she also began repeating the same thing over and over again. And so her children finally took her to see a neurologist, and Beth was diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease. Now, we spoke with her daughter, Meg Onesworth Steer, because Meg wanted to care for her mother, but with two young children at home, it just wasn't possible. So they looked at assisted living centers near where Meg lived in Boston.
So she did go and visit a few assisted living centers with me. I thought I had her. And she just, like, we went to lunch and she just looked around and she was like, not me, not now. And I was like, okay, you know, and that's when we had this conversation about, she's like, I don't want to be in a place where I'm just surrounded by old people. I want to be in a place where there are, you know, babies too and young families, and I can feel a part of a community. And I was like, well, I can't begrudge you that. That actually makes a lot of sense to me too.
So Beth stayed in Philadelphia, but it wasn't easy. Daughter Meg had to find full-time aides to take Beth to all of her appointments and to help with all of her daily activities. Meanwhile, the disease progressed.
It got to a point when I took her to the neurologist. He would give her a mini mental state exam, and 30 is normal. My mom was testing at a 4 at that point, partially because she has aphasia, and so she doesn't really understand words. And so he was like, you know, she's not gonna be able to answer the questions that were like, you know, do you know who the president is? Do you know where we are right now? Do you know what time it is? Can you read the clock?
So the family decided it would be better for Beth to live in a memory care facility. And they found a good one near Boston. Beth moved in 2018. And ever since then, Meg and the family have been paying about $100,000 out of pocket for the facility every year.
What worries me is that I know I'm on the luckier side and it's still not perfect. So I can't quite fathom what it's like when you have to go to a facility that can't possibly, you know, retain the aides that they want. And so their numbers, their ratios must be off. They have to be. Or where aides are just less engaged and involved. They're just kind of physically there, kind of like the first aides that I had, but not really assisting, you know, and engaging with and kind of trying to love the resident. And then the people who can't afford care at all, I don't know how that's possible.
Meg visits her mother often. Beth is nonverbal now. However, Meg gets to communicate with her in a different way, by singing.
What it be lovely.
Beth Onesworth turns 80 this May, and we spoke with her daughter, Meg. Well, I'd like to bring Dr. Tia Powell into the conversation now. She's a professor of psychiatry and bioethics at Albert Einstein College of Medicine and author of Dementia Reimagined, Building a Life of Joy and Dignity from Beginning to End. Dr. Powell, welcome to you.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
So Iris Van Sloten, right at the beginning of our conversation, said something very, very important about the fact that the Dementia Village in the Netherlands begins its model of care from a very different place, right, at looking at what does this person need now to maintain their independence and their humanity. How different is that perspective from the way, you know, we here in the United States have seen the needs of dementia patients, say, in generations past?
It's such a beautiful question. I think, you know, as a bioethicist, really all of our challenges can be summed up by the tension between maintaining freedom, which is part of what all human beings strive for, and safety. And this argument's been going on forever, for hundreds of years. So I do think that many of the ways in which we provide care today in the U.S. for people with dementia do not focus on care, but they focus on other issues, you know, maintaining regulations, all kinds of other things. And we have forgotten about freedom and joy. But it doesn't have to be that way. And in fact, this argument's been going on literally for hundreds of years. I could tell you a bit about the history, which helps us understand what we might learn from the past and also clearly what we have failed to learn from the past.
Yeah, I mean, I'd love a little Cliff Notes version of that history.
Yeah, it's a huge thing, so we can't do the whole thing. But I'll just tell you for a minute about Dorothea Dix, who was a fascinating reformer in 1840s. She was such a pistol. She wrote this incredible letter, which, because women couldn't speak to the Massachusetts legislature at that time, had to be read out by somebody else. And in it, she described the experience of people who were cognitively and emotionally not okay. There was no specific diagnosis of dementia back then. I mean, the word dementia praecox was actually schizophrenia. It's not even the same thing. But everybody who was sort of not okay was kind of lumped together. And what we did with them was horrible. Many simply died in the streets. Other than that, we didn't really have a place to put them, so we put them in whatever place we had. We sent them to jail. We had kind of almshouses for the poor. And Dix described one woman in the middle of the Massachusetts winter in the 1840s, with the temperature 3 degrees Fahrenheit, who was stuck in a little kind of cow shed with no heat and barely in any clothing and was crying out in misery. And that was representative of what we did with people back then. So she started this movement saying, and again, this is the safety versus freedom tension. She said, don't leave these people to the, you know, whoever is being paid a pittance to take care of them. We should bring them together and we should have caring, devoted people, well-funded institutions. And she organized what have become modern, well, we're kind of 19th and 20th century mental institutions with like lots of light and fresh air, and you could absolutely go outside, and the caretakers were well paid and well trained, and it was lovely. And it fell apart over time and became what we knew as sometimes enormous and inhuman and horribly abusive mental health institutions, mental hospitals. And by the time we started saying, this is not working, let's get over, there were, I think, 500,000 people housed in mental institutions in the U.S. in like the early 60s. So it started out weirdly with many of the wonderful features that Iris was describing. You can be outside, you can eat what you want, you can wear what you want. All of that fell apart partly because of, you know, not paying attention and the loss of the initial leadership. But so today, there's a huge emphasis in policy on, let's try and keep people out of institutions. Let's keep them in the community. And many, many people, including with dementia, say, that's what I want. I want to stay home. But that's not perfect either.
Right.
There are so many. This week, there were two publications about the medical impact of loneliness and isolation, that it increases all-cause mortality, particularly in the elderly population, enormously. And for dementia, it makes it makes you 9 years more likely to get dementia early. Social isolation does so. Just having people live in the community and having no institutions, that doesn't work so well either. So figuring out who needs to go where, can we have a range of choices, can we support people at home, can we address isolation, can we have organized things that don't need to feel institutional, which is the great success of Hogevec.
Yeah, so we have about 30 seconds before our first break, Dr. Powell. I just want to quickly know, how far of a leap do you think it is between the different kinds of models we have now here in the United States? Nursing homes, you know, adult day facilities, memory care, assisted living. How far is that from the dementia village that Iris has been describing?
Well, there are 26,000 nursing homes in the U.S., and they're very, very different. But some are getting close. Uh-huh. I don't think it's impossible. I don't think we are succeeding yet in the U.S., but I don't think it's impossible, and I would love to see that happen.
Okay, good. So that gives us something to aim for then. So Dr. Tia Powell and Iris Van Sloten, we have much more to talk about when we come back. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we're talking about whether a model for dementia care first started in the Netherlands, and it's a dementia village, could actually work here in the United States. And I'm joined today by Iris van Sloten. She is an advisor at Be Advice, an advisory board for the Vivian Care Group, and that's the care provider that created Netherlands' first ever dementia village in 2009, the first ever in the world, really. And Dr. Tia Powell is with us as well. She's at the Albert Einstein College of Medicine and author of Dementia Reimagined. And Iris, there's a question I wanted to ask first of you, and that is, you know, in a sense, I'm almost setting up this conversation as care versus cure, right? Because we haven't yet found a cure for dementia. I'm wondering how people in the Netherlands look upon the dementia village because, you know, are they saying, well, this is all well and good, but we should still need to be, you know, pursuing a medical cure for this disease?
I think it's both, but I would say that when you look at the Dutch society, then you really see a shift throughout the last decade that there's more attention more education about dementia in general. People are talking more about dementia-friendly communities or places. There's more in the news, more education. So people are becoming more aware of dementia and what it's all about.
Okay. Now, Dr. Powell, I'm obviously asking this question from a decidedly U.S. point of view, right? Because it seems to me that, you know, the American healthcare system from, you know, at every level, whether it's the, you know, the care team in the hospital to the executives in the C-suite at pharma companies, the goal is cure, right? We will keep you alive. We will eliminate disease. We will extend your life. And care is what we do until we get the cure, right? It's like a secondary or even a sort of a stopgap measure while we're waiting for a cure. That's the attitude of the U.S. healthcare system here. I mean, does that apply in the world of dementia care?
It does, although I do think that is starting to soften. There is more and more understanding how much a difference quality of care makes. I mean, to take one example, we've made huge progress in treating cancer. Lots of people get better from cancer, live with cancer, do for it. And the major cancer hospitals are starting to focus on care. They're doing a great job with cure, but they offer a massage. They offer visits with pets and animals in the hospital, which would never have happened 20 years ago because animals, they're unclean. We don't want a puppy or a cat in there for you to pet them. So there is some softening about, wait. Cure, first of all, isn't always available. And even when we're getting there, care remains important. So I don't think, you know, I hate to beat up on the U.S. healthcare system because globally we've all been nearly crushed by the pandemic. But there are many problems. And yet there is also room for innovation, including on this front, this very important issue that you raise.
I'll beat up on the U.S. healthcare system, but not but not because of the pandemic, right? Because it was not the workers themselves. Just I want to make that clear. But yeah. Well before the pandemic, this nation, as you know, was spending 20% of our GDP on healthcare, right? And the needs of people with particular kinds of chronic diseases are just going to ever grow. And it does seem to me that, again, in a nation with no universal care and a for-profit healthcare system, there are certain goals which have historically been more important than others, right? And that's why I was trying to understand how that sort of cure-care dichotomy works with dementia. And so do you think that those fundamental forces in American healthcare might make it easier or harder to adopt a new model like they have in the Netherlands?
In general, I think it's made it harder. We have put billions of dollars into researching medications and even occasionally devices that would help cure dementia. And I'm a physician. I'm certainly not opposed to cures. That's a beautiful thing. It is unlikely to be a dream that we will see anytime soon, surely not in my lifetime, and I'm not sure what we'll be able to do for my children's lifetime. So while we're waiting, I think we should draw upon the motto of the hospice movement, which is, let's try and make every day remaining a good day. Mm-hmm. How could we do that? How could we use our ingenuity and our policies and our government resources to focus on that as well? Yeah. And we don't. Other nations, specifically those that have universal health care, spend a lot more than we do on social services and supports. We put in a lot of money for healthcare, but it is very medical and much less on the kind of meals on wheels, that sort of expenditure mm-hmm. that our peer nations do.
You know, and from this conversation, though, I'm seeing that if we care to look, there's light on the horizon, right? Because Iris, you yourself have advised the opening of forms of dementia villages in other countries. And Dr. Powell, you had said that, you know, changes are being made. So with that in mind, I want to just quickly hear from someone else whom we spoke to. And this is Emily Roberts. She's an associate professor of interior design at Oklahoma State University, and she specializes in environmental gerontology. And in 2015, she visited several European dementia villages, obviously like the one that we're talking about in the Netherlands. And Professor Roberts wanted to replicate that model of care here in the U.S., but couldn't really figure out how. And then in 2017, she had an epiphany while walking inside a mall.
I walked into this place and it was just a total deja vu for the experience that I had at the Dementia Village with the sound and the light and the space, the scale, just the vibe.
And at the time, malls were closing left and right in the United States. In fact, estimates show that 10% of the nation's thousands of malls are still expected to shut down in the next 5 to 10 years. So Professor Roberts wondered, could a mall be repurposed into a dementia village? She worked with her students to design a model, and it included bars, restaurants, lots of open and outdoor space, healthcare on site, attached housing. And after a year or so of work, they held focus groups with healthcare workers, architects, local developers, and caregivers.
What I got from pretty much everyone that I talked to is like, I would love to live there, or I would love to have a family member live there. Just the concept of it, because we've all been to the kind of memory care settings that make our stomach turn, right? Where you walk in and people are in their rooms, or they're in a central loud dining room, and that's it. That is life. And that can't be.
But just because people in the focus group liked the idea, it doesn't mean they did not have reservations. And in fact, they had very specific ones. Questions kept coming up at each and every meeting, and they were about safety and regulation.
That juxtaposition between autonomy and safety, because that was one of the main things that came up in our focus group, is, okay, you're going to allow these older adults that might have cognitive decline to do what they want within this very large space. How does that work? You know, who's in charge?
And this tension, Professor Roberts says, is the biggest barrier to overcome here in the United States.
we can make the changes. We can see a model that's working. But in the United States, just because of the structure of our medical system and reimbursement system, it's just going to be a little bit more difficult. You know, the building part of it is not rocket science, but it's the way that it's integrated into our current medical system. It really becomes an ethical question.
And again, that ethical question, she says, is how the U.S. healthcare system views the balance between safety and autonomy for dementia patients. But Professor Roberts is not giving up. She plans to travel to Washington, D.C. soon and pitch the repurpose mall concept to various care groups and possibly even government officials. So, Iris Van Sloten, how would you describe the dichotomy, as we just talked about here, between safety and independence? I guess the question is, are people less safe in a dementia village model of care?
No. For instance, we do not have more falling, so we do not have more incidents than in other more traditional nursing homes. And I would also say that that's also part of the outcome of the model we do. Where the focus is not only on the medical part, but also a lot on the social part. We really promote active aging, so people use their muscles, they stay in a better physical condition, and then you will see that they will not just trip over just because they are allowed freedom to walk around throughout the entire neighborhood. And we carefully need to look at all the benefits that come from offering that freedom. And that often results in that people are in a much better condition. And when you focus too much on the risks and keep people inside or maybe even in their bedrooms or in wheelchairs, and then when they move, they are much more likely to fall or to have an incident than when you give that freedom to them.
Mm-hmm. Well, here in the United States, I would guess that a lot of that safety question has to do with around the question of liability, right, and legal risk in the United States, which is quite expensive here, but also that many patients, perhaps they're simply viewed by their caregivers and their families as needing much more close attention than the dementia care village model might be able to provide. Like, for example, we had a listener reach out to us, Jorge Spinoza, and Jorge lives in Long Beach, California. His late mother had Alzheimer's. She's passed away now. And he said he's heard of the dementia villages, but thinks it can't work for everyone.
So my mother, when she had Alzheimer's, it was very aggressive. She forgot how to speak and didn't recognize anybody within like a year. So she resembled more of just a very scared, you know, child. And having anything where she could probably just walk around and be free would probably be very dangerous, even if it is within the confine of a controlled space. I think she would have not done well.
Iris, I wonder how you would respond to what Jorge said.
Yes, well, I do not know all the details, of course. Yeah. So, what we do see and what our experience says is that the things Jorge mentions, we see that a lot of people with dementia, and we often talk about behavior we do not understand, people being aggressive, experiencing anxiety or stress or depressed. But we experience that we have a huge influence with the behavior, with our behavior, but also with the environment we offer to these people. So I'm very curious in what kind of place his mother stayed, what kind of attention she got. Mm. Because often that is also, the behavior is also a result of how we approach people and what kind of environment they're in.
Right, it may be part of the cause of the challenging behavior. Point well taken. Now, I should note that it's not as if, you know, none of the aspects of the Hoigovic model are in the United States. I mean, you've been working with a potential place in New Jersey, and there's also a day center in South Bend, Indiana that has this model incorporated into it. So, Dr. Powell, though, what I'd love to hear from you is, given what the U.S. healthcare system is, what do you think are the biggest barriers that need to be addressed that are currently preventing, you know, a much deeper expansion of this model of dementia care in the United States?
Well, I think there's sort of good news and bad news. I'll start with the bad news. Medicaid pays for most long-term residential care in nursing homes in the U.S., and the daily rate, there's a lot of data to support the notion that it simply does not support what it costs to care for somebody even in a traditional nursing home. So, you know, nursing homes are going out of business. They are working hard to bring in more short-term residents who are there for like 100 days paid for by Medicare, the program for older people, whereas Medicaid is the program for poor people. And Medicare pays better, and you can come there and have rehab after a hospital stay or something. So we don't pay enough to cover the care of just long-term living for people. So we need to figure out how to do that. I do think that there's some really interesting innovations. The most widely known is probably the greenhouse movement, which was started by a wonderful leader and innovator named Bill Thomas some years ago. And there are about 280 of these in the U.S., so not as many as 26,000 nursing homes, but it's getting started. They're small homes. They have a very level playing field. It's the staff members all do all of the things. It's 10 to 12 people. People per home. They always have an outdoor space that you can access. People who live there, you know, get to help make the meals, cut the carrots, do things. And there's, it's not a big, scary institution. It's very homey, and it's a place where you have contact with other people, you know them, and you have a lot of freedom to do what you want to do. So that's doable. That exists now today. There's still, you know, 280 does not cover a huge country like the U.S., so that's not available to most people. So figuring out, you know, lots of different options, there's no one option that will work for everybody. So it may have been that your caller's mother might not have done well in a dementia village, although I agree with Iris, that is more than I know. Excuse me. I think the ability to move around freely makes a lot of people less agitated, less grumpy. I think in the U.S., we would not describe the population Iris is describing as having severe dementia necessarily. Mm. For us, severe dementia may be bedbound, unable to feed yourself, that kind of thing. So that's a separate population. You know, we need to have different things for different people at different phases.
Mm. Well, it seems as if since 2009, this concept of a dementia village has really captured the attention of people around the world who are looking for better ways, right, to care for their loved ones and the members of their communities. So, Iris van Sloten, thank you so much for coming on the show and for sharing the Netherlands experience with us.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
And Dr. Tia Powell at the Albert Einstein College of Medicine and author of Dementia Reimagined, thank you as well.
Thanks for having me.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.